Tonight, our special guest on Coast to Coast, Greg Braden. His work, The Divine Matrix, Bridging Time, Space, Miracles, and Belief, is going to be another one of those classics. We'll be back with Greg in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. A former senior computer systems designer for Marietta Aerospace, computer geologist, Phillips Petroleum, and the technical operations for Cisco Systems, Greg Braden, is considered a pioneer in bridging the wisdom of our past with the science, healing, and peace of our future. For more than 20 years, Greg has searched high mountain villages, remote monasteries, forgotten texts to uncover their timeless secrets. Now, to date, his work has led to such paradigm-shattering books as The Isaiah Effect, The God Code, and his newest, The Divine Matrix, Bridging Time, Space, Miracles, and Belief. Greg's work will show us beyond any reasonable doubt that we've got the power to reverse disease, redefine aging, and even change reality itself by embracing the focused power of human emotion as the quantum language of change. We'll explain all that in a moment. Greg Braden. Hey, Greg, welcome back. How are you?
George, it's a pleasure to hear your voice, and I'm absolutely thrilled to be speaking with you from the snow-packed high deserts of northern New Mexico tonight.
Kind of an unusual snowfall out that way.
It has been, if you want to go skiing anywhere in the world, it's not in the Alps and it's not on the East Coast, it's not in the West Coast, it's right here in the Rockies this year.
This weather is just upside down, Greg. I don't know what's going on. Maybe that's part of this divine matrix.
We can talk. You know, George, what we're going to talk about tonight, this topic is so fundamental to everything that's happening in our world and in our lives that there is no topic that would not be relevant to what we're going to do tonight. So we can go anywhere with any of this tonight.
What do you mean by the divine matrix?
Divine matrix, it's a field of energy. George, Western science has just arrived within the last years of the 20th and now the early 21st century at an understanding that we have proven under laboratory conditions in the language of science that has been the place where ancient and indigenous traditions have always begun. So Western science is only now comfortable embracing the fact, and it is a fact now, that there is an intelligent field of energy that bathes all of creation, permeates everything in our world and beyond as far as we know, and with implications we're only beginning to understand. So scientists, they're publishing this in the journals, some great texts. Many of your guests have talked about this field. Scientists are looking at this and they're saying, okay, well, you know, this field is out there. What do we do with it? And this is the place where I believe it serves us to go into some of the most ancient traditions, some of them 5,000-7,000 years old in the case of the Vedas, because they began with this understanding. They said, sure, you know, everything's connected, and they spent their time 1,500, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years devising the understandings and helping to pass to future generations how this field applies in our lives. They didn't need to spend so much of their time proving that it's there for them. They used it in their lives.
Lynn McTaggart calls this the field. I have always called it a wireless internet. Are we all on that same page, Greg?
We are, George. This field is so new that scientists have yet to agree upon a single name. I've had the honor of sharing a stage a number of times with Dr. Edgar Mitchell.
Mm-hmm.
He calls this nature's mind. Stephen Hawking calls it the mind of God. Lynn McTaggart, the folks at Noetic Science, simply call it the field.
Right.
Max Planck, in 1944, in just a stroke of brilliance, identified this field as the matrix. And what he said, in 1944, he said that all matter, the stuff our world is made of, he said it originates and exists only by virtue of a force. And he said, we must assume behind this force the existence of what he called at that time a conscious and intelligent mind. And then he said, this mind is the matrix of all matter. And it was based on those studies that the movie series was actually based on the work from Max Planck back in the 40s.
Well, you know, if you look at some of these pictures, Greg, from the Hubble, and you look at this vastness of the universe, at least this universe, and we'll talk about the possibilities of more than just this one, but everything to me has purpose now. It has order. I don't know what it all means. I don't know why all these nebulas and constellations and various galaxies that we're stumbling across now, I don't know what their purpose is, but they all seem to fit some kind of larger puzzle, don't they?
Well, they do, George, and I think with the beautiful symmetry of everything we're speaking about, that there have been some very far-seeing scientists in our past. The Max Planck was one of them. Dr. John Wheeler, a colleague of Einstein's, who is still with us today, and I believe he's still active at Princeton University, he began talking about the implications of what this field means in our lives in a way that was very, very different from what other scientists were saying during his time. And even now, he's caught a lot of flack for some of the comments that he's made, because what this book, The Divine Matrix, is all about, what scientists are understanding under laboratory conditions, and what 5,000-year-old texts are saying to us, is not only does this field exist, and not only are we part of this field, but we have the ability, George, within each of us to communicate in a meaningful way with this field in ways that seem, in the Western world, miraculous on the one hand, and on the other hand, this is why we've spent time in the monasteries of the high plains of central China, mm-hmm. and Tibet and in Egypt and Bolivia and Peru, because it's in these places where people have retained the understanding of what this field means and how to use it in their lives, healing their bodies and doing things to us that look like miracles. But to them, it's not a miracle. It's a technology, because they have remembered something that actually was part of our culture. When I say us, I mean us in the Judeo-Christian West, until the instructions that tell us how we use this field were actually edited among the 45 books that were edited out of our biblical text in the 4th century. So when we began rediscovering the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Nag Hammadi Library, what we found was, as good as our Western biblical text is, and it's a good text, the best scholars will openly admit that it's incomplete. And now that we're fleshing out those incomplete pieces, what we're finding is that we once had as part of our history and our understanding the same thing that we find in these ancient and indigenous cultures. When we lost those understandings, their practices began to seem very strange to us, and we don't understand them. We call them primitive practices.
Do we think the Matrix occurred before this universe was formed, or did it come afterwards?
That's a good, very good question, George. And with the scientists I've spoken with, and in the research papers that we've had access to, the belief, no one knows for sure, so we'll just we'll preface it by saying that. But the belief is that it happened simultaneously with the birth of our universe, that there was a field of energy. There was a point in time when computer models and scientists believe our universe had just begun and it was expanding, but it had only expanded to about the size of a single green pea, if we can imagine that. So this is a fractions of a second after this primal moment that physicists call the Big Bang. And they say it was very compressed. If you took all the space out from between all the matter in the universe and compressed it into one place in time, it would be about the size of this green pea. And at that point...
Isn't that bizarre?
It is. You know, and I've got to tell you...
The
George,
brain can't
guys,
comprehend that. Great.
Well, they tell me that. And then they tell me it was about 18 million billion 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 degrees. And I said, come on, you guys, how do you know that? And they said, well, we don't know that, but we know it was hot. We know it was really small and really hot a long time ago. And as the universe began to expand very rapidly, as part of this expansion, this field is what was carried with the expansion. So into the void, the nothingness, or whatever it was that we believe was here before, this field began to expand and fill the universe as a substrate, if you will, or a framework, providing the container within which our universe exists. If we want to think about this field, it's the stuff that holds everything together. We know that, and that's what many people talk about. But it does more than that, George. It has also been found to be a bridge between our inner experiences of feeling and emotion and belief.
I think it's alive.
And our outer world. It is. It's a living essence. It's, number one, it's a container. Number two, it's the bridge between our inner and outer worlds. And number three, it appears to be, under laboratory conditions, and what the ancients said, also a mirror in the quantum essence of the stuff around us, of what it is that we claim to be real in our heart, coherent heart-based emotions. We'll talk about this tonight.
If it didn't exist, Greg, what would we have in this universe? Would we even have a physical realm?
Well, according to Max Planck, that's a great question, George. And according to Max Planck, the answer is no, we wouldn't, because Planck is saying that, and this is such a huge concept, he's saying that it's from this stuff, this non-conventional form of energy. It doesn't work the way we would expect energy normally to work. And that's why it's taken so long, scientists so long to validate it with our equipment.
Yeah.
But he said it's from this stuff that all physical matter originates. He says all matter originates and exists only by virtue of this force. So from his quantum perspective, 1944, what he's suggesting is if the field weren't there, that we couldn't have physical matter. It's the framework upon which the physical matter is actually hung, if we want to think of that in a visual sense.
That's incredible. But how do we know it exists?
Well,
we can't see it.
Precisely. We can't see it, and we've been hard-pressed to measure it because it is what's called a non-conventional field of energy. It doesn't respond to conventional methods of testing, to conventional electronic equipment. And there was a tremendous controversy back in the late 1800s, George, among scientists and philosophers and engineers as to whether or not this field actually existed, and a lot of heated debate. And there was a very famous experiment. It was first conducted in 1881 behind closed doors by a team, Michelson and Morley, and it was reproduced at Case Western University in 1887.
Well, they surely didn't have any technology, really, did they?
Well, you know, if you've got the concept right, George, you don't have to have some real advanced technology. If the concept is correct, there are ways to detect the field. But in my estimation, this was a good experiment. I think it was poorly interpreted, and what it's now called is history's greatest failed experiment.
All right, tell us what they were doing.
Well, let me just give an analogy. If our listeners right now were to walk out of their homes or offices or cars, wherever they're listening to this broadcast, if they moistened their index finger and held it above their head, and in the moment that they were holding their moistened finger above their head, they felt no wind against their finger. And from not feeling any wind against their finger, if they concluded that no air exists, that is the equivalent of the Michelson-Morley experiment. And we know that just because you don't feel wind in that moment doesn't mean the air isn't there. It's just not moving.
Exactly.
Well, the belief was that this field, if it in fact existed, there would be a motion. It was called the ether wind, and the field was called the ether at that time.
All right.
And because their equipment detected no motion in 1881 and then again in 1887, and these experiments, by the way, were published in the open literature, and I've put the references up on the website, and as we go through the evening, I can give the number of the references if people want to look these up on their own. But they were published in the American Journal of Science, 1887, volume 34. And what they said, they concluded in 1887, they said this field doesn't exist, George. And from that moment until the late 20th century, as good as our science and our physics have been and as well they've served us, we have been operating on the belief that everything is separate from everything else, that this stuff doesn't connect everything in the universe, and what happens in point A has no effect on what happens in point B. And if it looks like it does, it was just a coincidence. And now we have found ourselves in a place in the quantum world where the mysteries of quantum material have pushed scientists to do the experiments and to find the field exists. Now, this what's really interesting is that this same experiment was repeated again almost 100 years later, and it was in 1986. And this is the one reference I don't have up on the website, so I'm going to give it to our listeners. So
sure,
they can
and then tell us what happened, too.
Sure. It was conducted by a gentleman named E.W. Silvertooth. He was working on behalf of the United States Air Force.
E.W. Silvertooth?
Silvertooth.
All right.
He was working on behalf of the Air Force at the time. He repeated the experiment. He had better equipment, and lo and behold, George, he found not only did this field exist, but it existed within the parameters that were predicted 100 years earlier. It acted just the way Michelson and Morley believes that it would have with their equipment. He published this study in a very prestigious journal, Nature, volume 322, August 14th, 1986, page 590, and it messes everything up. And people, a lot of scientists just don't like to talk about it. The fact is, the experiment was repeated. It showed that this field is there, and it's led to a number of other experiments. And we can talk about those tonight.
Does this matrix allow us to have intuition, to be able to tap into the psychic realm, to be able to have telepathy between people we really connect with?
George, this is where it gets really relevant in our lives. Not only does it allow for these things, the belief now it is because this field is there that these things work the way they work. And beyond, remote viewing. When we're seeing halfway around the world or in another world from our living room, what is the conduit? We've got to ask ourselves, what is the conduit that is carrying our conscious awareness from point A to point B?
And what takes it there?
Yeah, we'll talk about some miraculous healings tonight. What we found is that there's a quality of human emotion that every human on the face of the earth is capable of. It's just a little shift in perception, and this quality of emotion literally will allow the stuff in this field to conform to what we feel in our hearts. So when we feel the feeling of the healing of a cancerous tumor, in the example I'm going to give later tonight, we can actually see inside the body of a living woman through an ultrasound, we can see her cancerous tumor disappear in the presence of three practitioners trained to hone this language of feeling in their bodies, and the field is the conduit that is carrying what they feel inside their bodies into the world around them. It's documented in Eastern traditions, and when I show this to medical people here in the West, George, they chalk it up to an anomaly and a miracle.
Do you think if you concentrate on this matrix, if you truly meditate about it, it puts you into it? You can go into it?
You're already in it, George. What we know is that it's not that it's out there somewhere. It's the stuff that holds everything together. Every cell in your body and my body and all of our listeners has emerged from the substrate of this matrix. It's what's holding us together right now. It's impossible not to be in this divine matrix. And what the scientists found in 1909, in their time, and what physicists like Dr. John Wheeler are saying today, not only are we part of it, it's impossible for us to be passive observers within this field. If we're conscious, if we are awake, we are always interacting and creating within this field, although we may not be conscious of what it is that we're creating. And that's part of our mastery that was described in 5,000-year-old texts. How we create, it's not a verbal language. It's the power of human emotion, George, and it's the very power that has been discouraged by males in the West for the last 400 years, well, 1,700 years.
Well, I was going to say, if people don't believe it, are they going to be able to get in it and use it?
They're already in it. And,
right.
and it's not, the beauty is
that
it's not something that we even have to believe. The studies, the experiments are solid. They're showing that this is there. They're showing that we affect this field through. Let me just back up a little bit.
Tell you what, why don't you hold that thought?
Sure.
Okay, we're going to take this break. Greg Braden's website, Greg Braden, BRADEN.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We're talking about his work, The Divine Matrix. We'll be back. Okay, just mark your calendar, those of you who live around the Austin, Texas area, because on the 27th, I'll be at KLBJ's Talk Fest in Austin of this month. We'll do a little book signing right after that before I got to pop on a plane, but should be a fun event. And I think Friday night, they've got a contest going on with a dinner with me. So far, no one has entered the contest. No, I'm kidding. But you just call the station, KLBJ. Listen to them. They're talking about it every day. But I'll be out there next week, and we'll do a program out of there on Friday night with Linda Moulton Howe and Alex Jones. So that'll be a fun Coast to Coast show. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Greg Braden, our very special guest tonight. Greg, let's pick up where we left off, if you want.
Sure. George, just before the break, we were just talking about the the role that this field plays in the universe and the role we play within the field. And one of the things that's fascinating to me is, and especially as a former senior computer systems designer, is that a growing number of mainstream scientists are beginning to suspect that our universe works like a massive consciousness computer. And this is actually the terminology they're using.
I like that analogy, too.
Well, it makes a lot of sense. And if we think of the way computers work, just as every computer has a language that it uses to get things done, it appears that our consciousness computer of the universe has a language as well, and it's a language that we call human emotion and the power of feeling and what we believe to be true in our lives. Now, when I talk about that in front of live audiences, people tell me, Greg, it can't be that simple, because in our culture, we've been conditioned to, as we mentioned earlier, to discount the power of emotion and belief. But what the laboratory experiments are showing, George, is just the opposite, that it is the power of our awareness, of our expectation. When we're looking at the world around us, we expect to see something to happen. That expectation is an emotion in our bodies, and it is that emotion that sets into play a series of events that extend beyond our body into the world around us through this field, the divine matrix. And we're actually affecting and having a direct effect on the stuff our world is made of in ways that we're only beginning to understand.
Okay, well, with a computer, you program it. You put in the software, and it does all kinds of wonderful things. What is the software for the matrix?
The software is the power of human emotion. It is the belief. If we make this analogy, when we think about a computer, computers have operating systems, XP or Windows 98 or Mac or whatever it is. For all intents and purposes, those operating systems are fixed. If you want your computer to do something different, you usually don't change the operating system. What you do is you change the program or the way the program is working.
That's right.
And that's what I love about this analogy, George, is because we hear so many people saying that we need to change consciousness. But in this analogy, consciousness is the operating system. And that's happening within this divine matrix. We don't change consciousness. We change what we put into the consciousness, and that is our feelings and our beliefs. What the experiments have actually shown is that human emotion has a direct effect on the DNA inside of our bodies, literally changing the shape and the chemistry of the DNA in our bodies, that those effects extend beyond our bodies on the quantum level into the world around us. And this is the disconnect between us and when we look at 5,000-year-old traditions and we say, well, those are primitive traditions, or we see indigenous people in my part, we know part of the world, we live in northern New Mexico, we're surrounded by indigenous traditions.
Is that like saying stress kills, Greg?
Well, it can. It actually can. We actually talk about that in the book. So, in the book, what I've done is I've chosen three representative experiments. George, there are many out there, but I chose three that I thought were really powerful. And anybody that goes to the website under references, they'll see everything we're talking about tonight, so they don't have to take these notes. But the first one, it was actually performed by a Russian laser physicist, Vladimir Poponin, back in the early 90s. And for the first time under laboratory conditions that I'm aware of in the open literature, he took the stuff our world is made of, tiny particles of light called photons.
Mm-hmm.
And he did something that intuitively, it tells me that we're on the verge of a big shift in the way we think of our world because of the thinking underlying this experiment. Because what he did, George, was he took some human DNA and he put this DNA into a closed vacuum vessel with the stuff our world is made of, these little photons. And he asked the question. He said, what effect does human DNA have on the photons? He's saying, what effect does the stuff we're made of have on the stuff our world is made of?
Well, how do we know the opposite didn't occur?
Well, in conventional Western physics, there's nothing, there's absolutely nothing in conventional physics that suggests there would be any connection. And that's why it's so very cool when physicists ask these kinds of questions. And what he found and what was documented in a very famous experiment that is called the Phantom DNA Experiment. People can Google that on the computer while we're talking. What he found was that in the presence of human DNA, the photons actually aligned themselves and were changed in the presence of the DNA. And when he took the DNA out of the tube, the photons acted like the DNA was still there. So to the best of my knowledge, under laboratory conditions, this is the first time we have seen documentation where the stuff we're made of is affecting our world. That's the first experiment. The second one was done by the folks at the Institute of Heart Math in Boulder Creek, California, where they isolated human DNA. It was placental DNA, so it wasn't in the body. It was in a vessel that was still kept alive. And they asked the question, they said, what effect does human emotion have on this DNA that's in this vase? And there's absolutely nothing in conventional Western physics that suggests that an emotion inside the body of an individual would have any effect on DNA several feet away. And what they found, they were able to measure both what they call the conformation or the shape, as well as the light properties of the DNA. And the bottom line was, as the emotions changed, the DNA changed in the presence of anger, hate, jealousy, rage, what we call negative emotions.
Okay, this is very similar to what Dr. Emoto has done with his water crystal pictures.
It's similar. It's
right?
Similar. It's similar, George, but here's the connection. What they found was this. Those are independent experiments. They may not even be aware of one another, and they're interesting. But when you put them together, along with other supporting experiments, they begin to tell a story. Because what the second experiment showed was that emotion is changing the DNA, and the first experiment showed that the DNA is changing the stuff our world is made of. So you take out that middle link, and what these experiments are showing is that when we can create certain qualities of feeling and emotion, these aren't thoughts, George, and this is the disconnect in the West. These are what are called coherent, heart-based human emotions, genuine emotions of love, compassion, forgiveness, hate, anger, jealousy, rage. We can create those kinds of feelings in our heart. They are changing the stuff we're made out of, and the stuff we're made out of is having a direct effect beyond our bodies on the stuff our world is made of, which is just what the ancient traditions are saying. And now modern scientists are beginning to understand this because they now have documented the existence of the field as the conduit that allows these kinds of things to happen. So this is the technical side that we're talking about. This is how feeling is the language that programs the consciousness computer of the universe. Now, we're talking in abstract terms, but all of a sudden this becomes very relevant in our lives because further experiments and the documents have shown in the open literature, as we mentioned earlier, spontaneous healings in the bodies of individuals and people around
them.
That's for one individual. I worked with a number of other authors in Princeton University on global experiments where Princeton University used their equipment that can measure shifts in human consciousness on a global level.
This is the egg testing?
It was GCP, Global Consciousness Project,
right.
When Dean Radin was with
exactly
with Princeton. And what we did was we organized hundreds of thousands of people to feel the feeling of peace in a window of time. And Dean called the people we were working with. He said, hey, what are you guys doing? You know, there's a blip on the screen.
With his random generators.
Yes,
right?
All we had done through the World Wide Web was we had taught people to feel these feelings of coherent emotions of peace. They weren't asking for peace or hoping that peace occurs or saying, dear God, please let there be peace. They were feeling the feelings as if the peace were already there. And this is what was showing up on the graphs at Princeton. And in major population centers around the world, statistically, what happened was that crimes against people declined during the time hundreds of thousands of people were doing this. Emergency hospital room visits declined, and it happened on this day in the cities where the stock market was, like in Chicago. The market actually soared during the window of time that this happened, and then all those statistics reversed.
That's amazing.
When people stopped. Well, this... George, this was all based on experiments that were done back in the early 1980s during the Israeli-Lebanese War when practitioners were trained in techniques of TM during that time, Transcendental Meditation. And they were to feel peace, not to ask that peace come to pass.
Not a prayer session.
And it wasn't. It was a very empowering place of simply feeling as if the peace were already there. And when they were placed in the war-torn areas in the early 1980s, the first Lebanese-Israeli war, during the window of time that the experiments were conducted, the terrorist activity stopped completely. Crimes against people declined. Emergency hospital room visits declined. And the scientists did it again and again just to make sure it wasn't a fluke. You know, it wasn't a certain holiday or a certain time of day or a lunar cycle or anything like that. And they published the results in a magazine. It was called the Journal of Conflict Resolution, December of 1988. And it was from these kinds of results that the other studies began. The bottom line to all of this, we could talk about any of these individually, make a whole program of it, but the key is, and what's being shown, is that something we do by choice inside of our bodies is having a direct effect on the world beyond our bodies, whether it's the healing of a cancerous tumor that we spoke about in the first segment, or whether it's peace between nations that we're talking about now.
Is it because it's affecting other people, or does it truly have some kind of an effect on an event?
Well, probably both are happening. And the Princeton studies, great scientists, wonderful people to work with, and I have tremendous respect for them, and I want to honor their work. They were the first to say, we don't know exactly why this works the way it works. The sense is, the suspicion is, that a few people focused who have learned to hone this language, they will transcend many people who are chaotically having this experience but don't know that they're doing it. In other words, people just going about their lives and don't really know what it is that's happening in the Middle East, for example, and a relatively few number of people who have honed their heart-based emotion of peace. And peace is what was experienced while they were doing that. And what it tells us statistically, George, the formula that was put together based on these studies tells us that relatively few people can have a profound effect on the world around them, on their communities, and even between nations. When we have learned to feel these feelings, not think them in our minds, and not ask that they be granted to us. We all do that from time to time, and that's a form of prayer, and it's good. It works. And this is a different way of looking at the world, suggesting that we're part of everything we see rather than separate from. And because we're part of all that we see, we're part of the solution as if we choose.
So is it safe to say we know it works, we just don't know how it works?
I think that's a good thing to say now. We could study it for another 100 years, George, and we may not understand it fully, but I believe we do understand it well enough that we can apply what we do know to help us become better people and create a better world in a world where we're facing unprecedented challenges in recorded human history, and where many people feel that if we're not at the brink, we're close to a brink of making choices that cannot be reversed and will forever change life as we know it in a way that we don't want to make those changes. Whether we're talking about a third global war, we're talking about nuclear proliferation, we're talking about powerful viruses on the planet that medicine doesn't know what to do with, as different as those things all seem, all of them are linked through this field, this divine matrix, and we now know that we are empowered as individuals and collectively. When we learn the language, first it's just becoming aware of how this field works. Secondly, it's learning to speak to this field in a way that is meaningful and responsible in our lives. So the fact that everything's connected, George, I know it's nothing new. We've heard it so long for many people, it almost doesn't mean anything because they haven't been able to use this connection in their lives. This work now is showing us not only are we connected, but this field provides the container and the bridge between our inner and outer worlds, and the mirror in the world around us for what it is that we choose to create in our hearts. And the irony is that to have collective results, we've got to learn to work together.
How does evil fit into this, Greg?
Well, that's a really good question. It might be too big to address before we go to the top of the hour, but what scientists now believe, what the evidence shows, and what 5,000-year-old texts tell us, is that this field appears to be neutral, an unbiased field. In other words, it doesn't know about our judgments of right and wrong and good and evil. It simply reflects what it is that we give it to work with, on the one hand. On the other hand, and this is, I think, the answer to the question you're asking, George, what the studies have shown, what scientists found, is that whatever someone wants to place into that field, they will experience in their bodies first before it ever goes anywhere in that field. So for those who are choosing to use this field for peace, love, compassion, understanding, their bodies, those are life-affirming emotions, and their bodies, that's the signal that sends the information to their brain that floods their bodies with life-affirming chemistry, and that life is what's perpetuated through the field. Anger, hate, jealousy, rage, those are life-denying emotions. And whoever it is that is attempting to send those kinds of energies in this field, they'll experience them in their bodies. Their heart will send that anger, hate, or rage to their brain, and their brain sends life-denying chemicals, increased stress hormones, lower immune response, decreased DHEA levels. And this is what the laboratory experiments are showing. So it's almost like a fail-safe. It's the field. I don't want to say the field doesn't care, but it's really a neutral field. And because of the way our universe, this corner of our universe, appears to work, we experience first whatever it is that we choose to put into that field before it ever goes anywhere else.
But but are you saying it does not distinguish the difference between good and bad?
The way the field, the quantum essence, the stuff itself appears to be neutral and unbiased, is the word that the scientists, the experimenters are using. The consciousness within that, and this is probably what we're going to get into in the next hour, what does this field mean in terms of consciousness? What does it mean in terms of heaven? What does it mean in terms of multiple dimensions? You were talking about these in your first hour of your program tonight. Telepathic experiences, out-of-body experiences, all of these things come into play when we're talking about the divine matrix. So it's not that the field itself appears to be a neutral field, but the consciousness within that field does know about right, wrong, good, and bad.
See, I think if someone, and just hear me out for a second here, Greg. Actually, a second is all you're going to hear me out for, because we're at the top. So
right.
we'll come back and talk about this when we come back, Greg.
Great.
But basically, I want to talk with you about how an individual uses this divine matrix.
Sure.
And how it can backfire on him if he doesn't use it the right way.
Sure, I'll meet you here at the next hour.
You got it. I'll be back in a moment. Greg Braden, our special guest tonight. Last hour, we'll open up the phone lines on Coast to Coast AM. Our special guest tonight, Greg Braden. And he's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Greg Braden. Greg, you always say that we're in this matrix, but a lot of people aren't aware of it. They don't know how to use it. So what good is just being in it all the time?
Well, I think the answer to that question, George, is what our time in history is all about. And this, I thought we probably wouldn't get in this till the next hour, but we can do it right now. I think this...
This is the next hour, Greg.
Well, the conditions, the conditions that we find ourselves in the world today, George, I think are pushing us to accept the responsibility that comes with knowing what we know and using our technology the way we use it in the world. I heard during our station ID a couple times, there's an interview with you, and you're referencing... And the term was being used, end times. Were the listeners hearing that as well, or was that just on my end?
Just on your end.
Ah, okay. Well, it was. I know you've had a lot of guests on who are talking about this being a very unique time in the history of our world, in the history of our civilization, and what that uniqueness means. It means different things to different people. Are we heading toward a time where things are going to change? Probably. Is that change destined to turn out one certain way? Probably not. And I think rather than looking at it as a time of end times, I think what we're looking at is a time where we individually and collectively get to find out the level of mastery that we have in this universe. It's like we've had the training wheels on for so long. And as those training wheels come off, we are discovering that this world around us is nothing more and nothing less than a mirror in this divine matrix of what we have created, consciously or not. I'm not saying everything out there is a conscious creation. I'm saying that to transcend our time in history, to survive what we see on the horizon, we've got to find out that we are not passive observers. And, George, I think it's almost universally, in the last 5 years, I've been on every continent of the earth, not every nation, but every continent. And we've spoken to people from all over the world, sometimes directly, sometimes through translators, and they're all saying the same thing. They all sense that we have a power within us that is untapped. There's a potential.
Well, there's no question about it.
Yeah,
that.
And you explore it on this program all the time, and that's the beauty of Coast to Coast as a forum, probably the best in the world to do precisely what we're doing tonight. A big part of that power is our acceptance of the fact, and it is a scientific fact, that we each have the ability to create a quality of feeling in our hearts, not thoughts in our minds. And this is a big disconnect here in the West. That feeling that we have in our hearts is directly affecting the physical stuff our world is made of. It has a direct effect on everything from the individual healing of a body to the collective peace of a planet, to whether or not we have that war or not. In my part of the world, Native American traditions, they know, for example, when they feel the feeling as if rain has already happened, and I give this example in the book, I've seen it happen. They feel the feeling of what it feels like to stand with their feet in the mud of their Pueblo village because there's been so much rain, and they smell the smells of the rain coming off the earthen walls. And within hours, there's a rain cloud over their village. It's maybe not in the surrounding communities, but it's there. Can we prove that scientifically? Probably not right now. But what we can say is the correlations are so high that there is an effect. Just like the correlations were so high with the woman's cancerous tumor disappearing when people felt the feeling as if she was already healed, or in the case of the Lebanese-Israeli war, that the terrorist activities dropped to zero and all the violent statistics declined during the window when people were feeling peace. All they were doing was feeling peace.
Well, why do people have to feel the peace? Why doesn't this matrix take over on its own and solve the dilemma?
Well, that's a good question, George. I don't know that I know the answer to that. It may be that what you're asking is the fundamental question of who are we and why are we in this universe.
I mean, it seems to me that our involvement in this, whatever it is, is critical for its success and for events to occur.
I agree. And if we're to believe the way science is a language, and it's only one language that describes our universe, and it's a relatively recent language. It's only been around for around 400 years. There are other languages that describe who we are, how our universe works, and why we're here, and some of those are over 5,000 years old. They use non-technical terms to do that. My role as a scientist, I was trained as a scientist, and I support the scientific method. And what we know is that science is incomplete. As good as it is, it doesn't have all the answers. On the one hand, on the other hand, some of our most ancient traditions tell us how these things work, but they don't tell us why. Science gives us the mechanism, and the spiritual and indigenous traditions tell us how we use these principles in our lives. If we marry those together, George, that was my question. When the end of the Cold War, in the late 1980s, when I left Martin Marietta Aerospace, I was working on a project called the MX missile, the Peacekeeper missile. And I asked myself the question that we came so close to the brink of nuclear war on at least three occasions during the Cold War, closer than any of us would like to
be. And we may be even closer now.
Well, precisely. We're finding ourselves even on a more perilous place. My question was this: what happens if we marry the best science that we know today that tells us how things work with the wisdom that has worked so well, it's lasted 5,000 years and gotten us to this place, that tells us how to apply what science knows in our lives? What if we marry those two things together into a greater wisdom? What does it say to us? And what the texts have always said, and the traditions, the living traditions today, and we've just we were 39 days in the monasteries, 12 monasteries and two nunneries in Tibet in August of 05. So it's been about a year and a half since we were there.
What is it about those monks in monasteries?
Well, as a scientist, George, I was trained to look in the world around me for the answers to some of our deepest mysteries. My thinking was that we would find the clearest answers in the places that have been least disturbed by Western civilization. And the monasteries of central China and Tibet, of the Sinai Peninsula in Egypt, southern Bolivia, and in the mountains, the Andes of Peru, were good candidates because they've been so some of the most isolated, rugged, magnificent, pristine places left on the earth today. I mean, you got to work to get to these places.
Oh yeah, Shangri-La. Huh?
And when you do though, this is the value. You can sit down, look at another human. You're not reading a text and speculating on what that translation may be saying. We're not guessing at what a mural on a temple wall says. We're heart to heart, eye to eye with another human, and either directly through a translator, George, I can look at these people, beautiful people, and say, when you healed that miraculous healing that I just saw, or when you were doing these seemingly miraculous things on the outside, what did you do on the inside? How did you make that happen? How did you do that?
Mm-hmm.
And the beauty is, these people have no ego, and to them, they laugh because they just assume everybody knows the world works this way.
It's normal. It's natural for them.
So the first thing they do is they giggle. They love to giggle, you know, and then they'll say, well, if you really want to know, we'll tell you. And I talk about this in the book. This was 1998. It was in the presence of an abbot that we had traveled 6 days out of Lhasa, Tibet, over 17,000 feet above sea level to acclimate to be in this one monastery, to look at this this very ancient abbot in the eyes in 98. When we were back in 95, by the way, he had died, so I'm glad we saw him when we did. I looked at him in the eyes, and through the translator, I asked him the question. I said, when we see your prayers on the outside, when we see you chanting for 14 and 16 hours a day, and we see the bells and the bowls and the gongs and the chimes and the incense on the outside, I said, what are you doing on the inside? And through the translator, he said back to me, he said, you've never seen our prayers because a prayer can't be seen. He said, what you're looking at are the things that we do to create the feeling in our body, and the feeling is the prayer. So the feeling is the prayer, not the words. And then he turned the question on me, and he said, how do you do this in your culture? And I began realizing that in our culture, when our most cherished traditions, when the New and the Old Testament were edited in the 4th century, we lost some good material. 45 books were edited, 25 were removed completely, the others were condensed and rearranged. And now that they're being recovered in the Nag Hammadi Library and in the Dead Sea Scrolls, we find what was lost. And what was lost, George, are the words in a 2,000-year-old text or 2,500-year-old text that tell us what quantum physicists are now discovering, that the power of emotion and feeling is the language that this divine matrix, this field, nature's mind, recognizes. And when we can feel in our hearts the things that we choose to experience in the world, the field will mirror it back to us. We've got to give that field something to work with. So people say to me, Greg, it can't possibly be that simple. I've seen it in the laboratory. The papers are published. We have video footage that we show in our live programs. And I say, why would it be any more difficult? So collectively, now this is interesting. If the field is mirroring what it is we feel, and every day we are bombarded with images of fear,
mm-hmm,
and war and disease,
sure,
and a little graph, not only are we afraid, we're told how much to be afraid. If it's an orange or a red or a yellow threat day, we're told how much to fear. Is it possible that what we're seeing in the world today collectively is the mirror of our collective fear?
Well, that's possible, too.
And if it is, and it works the way that the experiments show, what would happen if we felt just the opposite? What would happen if we felt differently?
Earlier, you said basically that the matrix doesn't distinguish, I'm paraphrasing you,
sure,
between the good and the evil. It's basically middle of the road. But let me ask you this. I mean, I know just in my own experiments over my lifetime, Greg, that if you create evil thoughts, and by doing so, you're tapping into this matrix,
right,
and send them out, it comes back tenfold to destroy you. You know, if you think, you know, I want Greg Braden to get sick tonight, you'll come back with some horrible flu that'll hit you.
The person that's creating
the creator, exactly.
That thought, right.
Why is that then? If this matrix is supposed to be neutral, that there's, you know, yin and yang, it's, you know, positive, negative, it's the same, it balances. Why is it when somebody attempts evil, it eventually comes back and really gets them?
I think a part of this may be, this is so new, George, we're still exploring the language and semantics maybe coming into it here, and I think we're both essentially saying the same thing. The field, the matrix, is the overall container. It's the stuff that holds the universe together. Within that container, it appears that consciousness is like a sub-program, if you will. And consciousness is the operating system that we're working with. So it is our responsibility as the role of programming what it is that we're experiencing. It's our responsibility to recognize right and wrong and good and evil. And the fact that it comes back, both good and good comes back tenfold as well.
I agree with that.
The good, and we've seen it in the healings. It takes a relatively few number of people to create that kind of healing. Actually, statistics show it's the square root of 1% of a given population. Square root of 1%. I've shared that number in this program before. The square root of 1% of any population is a very small number. So in a city of 1 million people, to create a feeling of peace or an experience of peace, it takes a little over 100 people in a city of 1 million, or on a planet of 6 billion people, the square root of 1% is a little over 8,000 people, and that is the minimum number to kickstart that experience of peace. The more that, obviously, it participates, the greater the effect. But what it's saying, in quantum terms, in modern experience, is essentially the old parable, George, that the power of the mustard seed. It takes a relatively few number of people that understand this language and can hone their feeling. There's a whole conversation we could have about how scattered, I mean, our feelings in our heart. How often do we really have the ability to hold a focused, coherent emotion in our hearts of something that has already happened, of the healing of our loved ones that's already happened, or the peace in our community? So when these experiences are mirrored back to us, I think it shows us how pure and how quickly we can change what we see happening in our world.
Yet, Greg, not everyone who believes gets healed. You know, let's say here's an example, somebody's got cancer, and you cited the example of a tumor that went away. I believe that happens. But then we also have someone who believes, who prays, and their cancer spreads, and they end up dying. Why does that happen?
George, the first thing I'll say is we never have all the information, and I wouldn't claim to know all of the reasons. I mean, if we believe in karma, if we believe in past lives, and all kinds of things may come into play. But I understand your question, and I've seen this happen. I know the man that filmed the tumor disappearing in the medicineless hospital, and I asked him the question. I said, those three practitioners helped that woman to heal. Could she have done it on her own if they weren't there? And he said, you know, in all probability, she could have, but there's something about us humans in that we feel more empowered when we're supported by others that believe as we do. And the flip side of that is if she did not make the changes, and what I didn't say, and I apologize because this is the rest of the story, before those people in those medicineless hospitals undergo those healings, they're trained in life-affirming ways to change their life. They learn new ways to eat, new ways to breathe, new ways to move, all the things we're talking about in our country, diet, exercise, you know, fresh air, nutrition. If those three practitioners had created the effect of that healing in her body, and she had chosen to stay with the old lifestyle, it's very possible that that healing would be temporary, just as today. I have friends who've had cancers that have been removed surgically. 6 months later, they come back, and then mm-hmm. they say, well, you know, I thought the doctor got it, and they got that one, but because they never changed the belief or the lifestyle that the belief is allowing for, the blueprint in what we would call the divine matrix, the stuff where matter originates, that blueprint has never been addressed. And I think for on a small scale, that's the answer we're looking at. On a big scale, on a global scale, we're all looking at the same principle on a very large scale. Are we learning that diversity is our greatest strength, and that the cooperation is going to get us further than competition? And I think that is the question that we are answering at this moment in this time in history.
Well, are you convinced that there's an intelligence then in this matrix?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it's interesting because when you look at the way scientists describe this matrix, George, it except for the language, it sounds a lot like what we would call heaven or the heavens in the ancient traditions.
You stole my question.
Sure.
But you're right.
Where if there is an essence to life that leaves the body at the moment of death, where does that essence go?
Mm-hmm.
The ancients say it's in the heavens. What modern researchers and scientists now believe is that that energetic essence is now part of the collective that is in this divine matrix, in this field, until it becomes individual again. It's the field is believed to be the seat of the soul, the origin of the heavens. It's where we go in between lifetimes, for people that use that terminology.
I'll have you give us some examples when we come back, Greg,
sure.
of people who have been able to use the matrix. I won't use the phrase tap into it because you believe we're already in it. So we'll talk about that and much more. In the next hour, we'll open up the phone lines. By the looks of things, you're calling already. Slow down. There's nobody here to answer them. I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment at Coast to Coast AM. And, of course, Greg Braden, our special guest. Like I said, next hour, we'll open up all the phone lines for you. I'll give you an opportunity to jump on board as we talk about the divine matrix. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Greg, let's talk a little bit also about, and I want you to give us some examples of how this all works, but what's the science behind this?
Well, the science in terms of the existence of the field or how it works, or both?
Both.
Well, this is the reason I've written the book the way I have, George. The first part of the book tells us the science. Some of it's so new it's not even in textbooks yet. The experiments that were done in the late 90s, for example, University of Geneva in Switzerland, Nicholas Gizen, where they were showing where they would take a particle, a quantum particle, split it in half so that each half was identical to the other. They had essentially twins. And they fired those particles in opposite directions from one another, 7 miles in one direction, 7 miles in the other. So they were 14 miles apart. And this gave them the opportunity to do these experiments that just astounded everyone. What they found was when they would disturb one of those particles on one end of the experiment, the other one, 14 miles away, acted like it was the one that was having the experience, as if they were still connected, even though they weren't. And in some cases, the connection was happening so quickly, it was traveling faster than the speed of light. So they knew that it wasn't one particle signaling another, that somehow they're actually connected, and the term that's used now is entangled. And this is a brilliant man, Dean Radin, now has a new book out, Entangled Minds, where he's talking about this phenomenon of entanglement. And there's another principle that comes in here that I'm sure many of our listeners have heard of a holographic principle. And the holographic principle essentially is the principle that it suggests that when we have a little fragment of something, that little fragment mirrors the whole something. So for example, if we were to take a few years ago back in the 80s, there were these shiny holographic bookmarks. You'd hold them in the light, and the image would look like it was floating above your hand.
All right.
And if anybody has these, you can do an experiment, but you can only do it once because you'll destroy your bookmark. You can cut that little bookmark into about a bajillion pieces, George, and you can take the smallest one and even cut it in half again. And if it's truly holographic, when you hold it under a magnifier, that little fragment, no matter what shape it is, you'll see the entire image in that shape, because that is the definition of a hologram. The whole is always reproduced in every fragment, no matter how small. And this is important because scientists believe, people like David Bohm and Carl Pribram, believe that our universe is holographic and that we are part of that. And the beauty of a hologram, and this is why it's so powerful in the universe, is because every piece reflects every other piece. When a change is made in one place, that change is mirrored everywhere else. And that is believed to be the reason why those particles separated by 14 miles. The question is, it's a trick question. I ask our live audience, as I say, if they're separated by 14 miles, how did the signal that one particle was being disturbed reach the other one 14 miles away so quickly? How did that signal get there, or did it? And this is the trick. The signal doesn't have to travel. It's already there because it is entangled. And because of the holographic nature, the signal doesn't go anywhere. It's already everywhere all the time. This is why remote viewing works the way it works. When our consciousness moves, the language we use is that our consciousness moves from point A to point B. The truth is we simply tune our consciousness into that place, but we're not really going anywhere. And this is the power of this principle in our lives. When we can feel the feeling as if peace has happened in a woman's body, and her body mirrors that halfway across the room, and we can see it through the ultrasound, we know that principle works. And this is why, if our listeners are listening, I know people out there, you've got loved ones in the battlefield of Iraq, half a world away, and you say, when I feel my prayer for my loved one, how does my prayer reach them on the other side of the earth? And the answer is, when you create that prayer in your heart, it's already there. You don't have to ship your prayer off anywhere. You can use your energy to feel the feeling as if your loved one is safe and as if they're already healed, so that the field can mirror that back to you. And that's the power of this field, the way it works. And these are some examples, some of the experiments. We know the field is out there because of the way the experiments are working. And then I shared earlier in the evening, we know that when we have certain kinds of emotions, we're affecting that field through those emotions. So that's what the science is showing us. Anecdotally, we've always heard about indigenous people creating rainstorms over their village, or the miraculous healings, such as the one I described in the Medicineless Hospital, or a number of people feeling peace in the Middle East. While they were feeling that peace, all that could happen was peace. But the question is, and this is what scientists ask, George, they say, if this is so powerful, why is it that when the experiments stop, all those statistics reverse? When those practitioners in the Middle East stop feeling peace, why did all the statistics reverse and the terrorist activities begin again? And this is the crux of the irony that was left to us in those ancient texts, because what they described is this feeling isn't something that we do every once in a while when we want to change the world. It is something that we become, and we can hold these feelings throughout the day. It's not something that we stop and do for a few minutes in a prayer or meditation, and then we get up and leave, and the prayer or meditation is over. If the abbot in the monastery in Tibet, he said to us, he said, feeling is a prayer. There's no words, no outward expression. Feeling is the prayer. Well, we're feeling in every moment of every day, so we're essentially in prayer. This is a modality of prayer, every moment of every day. And if that's true, we can feel that peace or that healing to some degree when we're driving down the freeway to work or in our office place or, at the family dinner table to the best of our ability. That is our workshop in life, to feel those feelings, even though the world around us may not always support or seem to support what it is that we're feeling.
Well, I was going to say, what are the practical ways, then, to use this in our day-to-day living?
Well, I know there are many modalities of prayer, and I've done programs on Coast to Coast where we've talked about these before, and what I'd like to say is that every mode of prayer is valid, it works. We all use them. Some prayers are called prayers of supplication, where we feel powerless. And we ask for help. We say, "Dear God, you know, help me out here, Archangel Michael," or whoever it is that's out there. And that's one way of looking at the world. This is another way of looking at the world, knowing that we are part of everything that we see. And because of that, we're part of the solution, and that we don't have to ask for help because we are the help. We may participate, as John Wheeler says. We may communicate with this intelligent field to bring about this outcome of healing or peace or abundance in our lives or whatever it is. The key is, and this is easier said than done, I know it is, because of our conditioning here in the West, the key is to feel the feelings as if our heart's desire or our prayer or what it is that we're choosing to experience has already happened, to feel as if the healing is already there in our loved ones, or if the peace has already happened at the family dinner table in our communities, to give that field. Remember, we're programs within this massive consciousness computer of the universe. So we've got to give that field something to work with. And the irony, and this is where I'll close this, and we can talk about this some more, but if we really think about the universe as a computer, and if we think about what we're doing here, George, we're living in a world that very obviously is experiencing a tremendous amount of hate, of rage, and anger. And if we think of ourselves as software, we are literally healing the software from within the same program that created the hate and the anger. We're transcending the anger and the hate while we're still in the anger and the hate. It's analogous to a program rewriting itself from within the program without external intervention or external help, because the program has the intelligence to do that. And that's, I mean, that's just an awesome way to think about what it is that we're experiencing here.
You know, the work you've done, how many years have you worked on this?
This is the result. I actually began working on this, George, when I was still an engineer with Martin Marietta Aerospace. And I did the first presentation in Denver, Colorado in 1986. And since that time, it's taken me 20 years sharing these concepts. And you and I, you know, we're talking about this a little differently than the way we do in the book or the way I might in some audiences. But it's taken me 20 years through audiences all over the world, and many of them through translators, to find a language to share these very profound concepts in a way that's meaningful and hopefully in a neutral language. This isn't about religion, although I can see where religions were built around the power and the wisdom of what we're talking about. But this force was there, the field was there long before religions were ever there, and our ability to communicate with this field has been with us since we arrived roughly around 200,000 years ago. So we've always had the language. Religions came along and wrapped themselves around the power of what it means for us to have direct access to the creative energy of our universe for healing, peace, abundance. And I think that's what this time in history is all about. We're recognizing that we are a family, that cooperation is going to get us a lot further than competition, especially for resources on our planet, and that war, I believe we're outgrowing the habit of using war to solve our differences, and then the question is, will we learn that lesson before this next great war?
I'm not sure if we are outliving it, to tell you the truth. I think there are too many people who just don't get it, Greg.
I think what will happen, I agree with what you're saying, and I can see where you would say that, George. There are two forms of two perspectives of consciousness that I'm seeing happening right now. And there's an old way of solving problems using military solutions and force, and there is a very powerful global current, and you really see this when you leave North America, of people who have recognized that, while we may not always agree with one another, that cooperation is going to get us a lot further than competition. And both of those things are happening simultaneously. And because of the way this field works, because of the hologram, because of the entanglement, because of the connectedness, I think it's going to be kind of like what we saw at the end of the Cold War. We knew some things were going on. We were using military strength to buy ourselves some time. And on the other hand, there were people that were working from a very different perspective to change things. And we'll never know everything that happened. From working with the military, I know that we never have all the information.
See, I agree with you when you say we're always in it. But I believe when you're in it, there are doorways. And in order for you to take advantage of being in it, you need to learn how to open up the doorway.
Absolutely, George. I'm with you 100%. And we mentioned earlier, you know, many people are looking at the anomalies of what are happening, of what is happening on our planet, physically, culturally, in terms of civilization. Everyone knows something's up. This isn't business as usual. Something big is on the horizon. Almost universally, the texts, the traditions, the prophecies, and I know you've had people on the show talking about mm-hmm. this, they describe some very frightening scenarios, and if you take the time to look closely, they always give an alternative. And for those listeners that have studied the Bible code, and I know you've talked about that on the program as well, some of the most frightening predictions in a 3,000-year-old map of what is believed to be a map of the quantum possibilities of our future, in the Bible code, some of those most frightening predictions of global war and Holocaust, and those are the words that are used. Right below those predictions, George, there's a phrase that not many people talk about, and I don't know why. But that phrase asks a question. When it shares those frightening possibilities, the phrase says, "Will you change it? Will you change it?" I get goosebumps just saying that. Will you change it? Implying that somehow the outcome that's so frightening is not set in stone, that somehow it's still malleable, it's still soft, and somehow that we are participating and have input and some choice in terms of how this time in history plays out. And that's why I'm so passionate about sharing this material, because we're part of the answer. It's not out there, and we can't wait for other people to figure this out. This is us. It's our time in history. I think history is going to look back at us, at this generation. They're going to say, this is the generation that chose peace because they had to to survive. But this is the generation that recognized that the 20th century is all about learning who we are.
What about greed, though? Where does greed fit in here?
Well, greed, I think greed is it's a byproduct of power. And power is a lot of what our time in history is all about. Where do we find our power? And do people that believe they have power, do they really have power at all? Because, George, ultimately what we're talking about, we talk about a force that connects everything and everyone has access to it. And we already know the language to speak to that force. What the ancients said is that opens the doorway to another force that nothing on this earth can touch. And those are the words of philosophers and ancient texts. What scientists are showing is that when we tap this power of emotion and we are tapping the emotion in our bodies to speak to the field in a meaningful way, that cancers can disappear. AIDS doesn't make any sense to our bodies. And there are people now that have transcended the AIDS virus, that they were born. There were documented cases of children born with AIDS that no longer have the virus in their bodies. And the question is, what do those children do? Are they taking drugs? Are they eating a mushroom in their refrigerator? Are they wearing a stone, you know, around their neck? And while those things may help, the bottom line is those children are feeling a love and support from their family. They don't know that they're supposed to die from this disease. And in the presence of those kinds of feelings of love, their body changes. And we've all got stem cells waiting for a command from our hearts to tell those stem cells where to go in our bodies to replace whatever mm-hmm. it is that's been damaged. But we're conditioned to believe that isn't possible. And all of these things are documented in the open literature. It's truly a miraculous way of looking at life. But what the bottom line is, it empowers us to be more than victims in our lives. And at this time in history, I think that's important. I think it's important for all of us.
You know, I use this every day in my life, Greg, all the time, except I am human. And there are some times I feel as if I've closed the door or I'm not in it anymore. Now, like you say, we're always in it. Sometimes I'm not sure.
Well, we have to be because, as Max Planck said, physical matter stems from this field.
I guess it's like being invited into a home. You're in this house. There are many rooms there, and it's up to you to decide where you're going to go.
You could think of it that way. I'm a very visual person, and from our audiences, when they think about this field, we're so conditioned to think, and people actually will take their left hand when they talk about the field, and they'll say it's out there, and they'll motion away from themselves. They'll say, out there somewhere. If we could think of the universe as a really thick blanket, and our bodies and our lives are fibers within that blanket, and every atom that makes up the cells in our bodies are a part of those fibers, it kind of gives us a sense that we're the fabric. We are the fabric of that blanket. We're the fabric of the universe. John Wheeler actually stated, Albert Einstein's colleague, who's still with us today, there. When I was in school back in the 60s and 70s, I was taught that there, essentially, we are relatively latecomers in the universe, have very little effect. The universe has been here a long time. We've come along recently. We don't have much effect now, and when we're gone, the universe won't ever know we're here, essentially, is what I was taught. And that's a school of thinking. Einstein was of that school. There's another school of thought, and John Wheeler exemplifies this, Einstein's colleague. He says, the universe may have started without us, and it may have been here for a long time, but it's not finished yet. And what he says is that the consciousness and us within consciousness, we are creating the building blocks for the universe, and it's an ever-evolving universe. So essentially what he's saying, if we ever wondered why we can't seem to find the edge of our universe with the Hubble telescope or with our observations, or why we can't seem to find that smallest particle of matter. George, every time we break one open, there's something else there.
Stay with us, Greg. We're going to get to the top of the hour and be back with phone calls. Well, I'll tell you now, last night's open lines, last Friday's fun and frolicky, tomorrow night could scare your shoes off your feet. We'll be back in a moment with Greg Braden and your calls on Coast to Coast AM. Well, welcome back. Greg, as we ran up to the break, I wanted to make sure that you had said everything you had wanted to say before we start going to calls.
Sure, George. I appreciate that. We were just talking about the two schools of thought that permeated the 20th century regarding our role in the universe and what it means in terms of this divine matrix. There was the school of thought that says, the universe has been here a long time. We don't have much effect on it, and after we're gone, not much is going to change. And then this was Einstein's way of looking at things. His colleague, John Wheeler, said just the opposite, said that consciousness is actually creating and building the universe as we go. And it's a profound thing to say. It may help explain why, for example, we can't seem to find the edge of our universe. We can't seem to find that smallest particle of matter. Because what John Wheeler is saying in words is being borne out under laboratory conditions. Every place we look, the act of consciousness peering at the edge of the universe or into the smallest particles of matter, expecting to see something, is an act of creation, George. It actually puts something there for us to see. But we already know that anecdotally. And I know all of our listeners have had these experiences, and we can laugh about it, but it shows just how this works. What happens if you've got 3 minutes to get to the bank and cash a check and get back because you have to be back at work, and you go in there knowing that you've got just a couple of minutes and mm-hmm. you've got to be out and you're in a hurry, what teller line are you going to end up in?
I'm always in the wrong one.
Well, exactly. If you're on the freeway and you're feeling that feeling, the tension. I live 4 hours from the nearest airport here in northern New Mexico, and there's a lot can happen on my way to the airport. And I can't tell you how many times I've felt that tension. I've got to get there. You know, people are waiting for me in another city. And as soon as I feel that, I'm going to get behind like a 52 Chevy pickup truck coming down the mountain road that hasn't moved for a year. And I have to laugh because I know that's the way it works. And it works just the opposite as well. So what we know is that it comes back to us in sometimes humorous ways, but the world is always showing us that we're interacting with this field of intelligence, this divine matrix. Some people will go through their lives interacting and never really understand how it works, and that's fine. And others will recognize that sense that something within us is untapped is an experience of a power that can be harnessed through our innate ability to feel. And the key and the bottom line to everything we're saying here tonight is that if we can learn to feel as if the things that we choose to experience have already happened, that is the language this field recognizes. The laboratory experiments show it. The ancient texts described it. They left us instructions telling us how to use it. I talk about all those things in the book in more detail. But that's the key. Science and spirituality are actually agreeing with one another in terms of our role in the universe and our relationship to this field.
When someone, Greg, says, gosh, I'm in the groove, I mean, it's almost as if there's nothing I can do wrong.
Yeah.
Is that being tapped into the matrix again as well?
I think it is, George, and it goes to the core of where we find ourselves in the West today. I mean, where did we learn to feel the feelings of the things that we don't want in our lives rather than the simplicity of feeling what it would be like as if those things were already there? That's a big question. It hasn't always been like that. It's not like that in other cultures. But when we lost the words that we rely upon to tell us who we are in the universe, in our case, in the Western Judeo-Christian traditions, they were edited out of the text that we trust. We still had the sense in our bodies that somehow there's more to us than we're being told, but the words that validate that were taken. So we began to feel powerless and separate and in lack in our world, and that simply isn't the case in other cultures, and that's the disconnect between going into a monastery in Tibet, for example, and into a laboratory in Denver, Colorado. So I'm not going to say if, because it's already happening, as we learn to marry the best of our science that tells us how things work, the mechanism, with the wisdom of our past that tells us how to apply those mechanisms in our lives, I believe that's a lot of what this time in history is about. And I think what's happening, George, is we're pushing ourselves to the point in science and technology through war, through disease, and all the things that are threatening our survival that we've got to figure this out. We've got to come full circle with science and spirituality and marry them into a greater wisdom to survive our time in history. And I think that's what this is all about.
All right, let's go west of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi there. This is such a wonderful program. This is all the beliefs that I have lived so many years. And I wanted to ask Greg, I had a brain tumor from birth, probably, or at least got it in my infancy to the age of 45. And I'd had many it's actually called a meningioma, so it isn't actually always referred to as a brain tumor because they're not malignant. But I'd had it for 45 years, and it got to be the size of an orange, and it affected me in many ways with insomnia as well as headaches and not a lot more than that, but I just felt really positive and full of love and trusted the divine order of life all those years. And then when I had, and I never have a cold or flu, and I still don't, but, and once I had brain surgery, when we found it, afterwards I went back to work. I did body work, massage for a living, and I went back to work 2 months after 10 hours of major brain surgery, and we got all the tumor out. And I just couldn't stay in joy. In other words, I felt joyful going back to work, and I just couldn't stay in it. The pain and the fatigue, and I suppose the area, they said, probably changed my personality. What I'd like to ask is, how can I get that back when there's a possibility of damage or just the trauma from the surgery or the exposure in the hospital, the entities possibly?
Sure. What's your name?
My name is Cheryl.
Cheryl, well, first I want to thank you for calling tonight. And
there's
so many things to what you're talking about, but there is a history and a precedent for any kind of major surgery for a period of time for people to feel, in a sense, a change in personality and a shift in their ability to emote, sometimes going to a deep depression.
Yes.
It's a bit of a mystery in the medical community. They will typically chalk it up to a non-physical. In their minds, if the surgery is successful, you're done.
Mm-hmm. They
and,
were done.
And there's another component to that. What I will say is that in the last 2 years, scientific articles have proven that every organ in our body, including organs that were believed to not be able to regenerate cells, organs and heart tissue, have been proven to be able to regenerate themselves. So I wouldn't be so much concerned about whether or not there was damage and something can't be repaired. We also know that we all carry stem cells, and those stem cells literally are just waiting for a signal to direct them to the place in the body. My dear friend, Dr. Bruce Lipton, has been on this program many times. Yeah, and he and I co-present all over the world together, and our work overlaps, but this is what we're talking about. What I really want to say to you is the love that you're talking about doesn't happen in the brain, and that's the interesting thing. Our heart is where love occurs, and what scientists have found, Cheryl, is that our hearts actually have their own neural tissue, their own brain tissue, brain-like tissue in the heart, that our hearts have a memory. And this is the power of emotion, heart-based emotion. So what you're describing to me, and it's easy to understand why you may feel that you lose confidence in your body to some degree after a tumor and after surgery. But that feeling in your heart is what sends the signals to the rest of the body that either affirm or deny life. So I would recommend focusing on heart-based emotions. And what the laboratory studies are showing, in the English language, the most powerful, healing, potent experiences come from the words that we call gratitude and appreciation. Other cultures, there are other words, but in our culture, it's gratitude and appreciation will trigger life-affirming DHE levels increase in the body, immune response increases. In response to what we call gratitude and appreciation.
And I live that way, and I don't feel a victim. I feel very empowered by the love that I do feel. It's the depression or the whatever it is in my brain that I can't seem to bring the joy back into my heart. You know, I can't laugh like I used to.
How long ago was your surgery?
It was in 94.
Well, I'm not a medical doctor, and I don't know everything there is to know about what's happening with you specifically. What I can say is what the studies have shown, what the research has shown, and what I've actually had direct experience with personally, and also through loved ones, is what I'm sharing, that those experiences are heart-based emotions. We think about them in our minds, but the feeling actually comes from the tissues in our heart, and that is where I would practice. That's where I'd focus, and what the studies are showing is that we have the ability to heal any organ in our body. So,
and I believe that.
So I'm going to invite you to maybe be concerned less about a damage that's been done, and not think of yourself that way, but to feel the feeling as if you are whole, healed, complete, see yourself in the way that you'd like to experience life. We have what are called mirror neurons, and the mirror neurons in our brains are what allow us to experience in our body what it is that we visualize in our imagination and feel in our hearts. So you can do a Google on mirror neurons and find out how they work in some of the practices and exercises that will help you to use those in your body.
Great. Thanks for calling. Next up, let's go to our East of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello. This is David. How are you doing?
Hey, David. It's good to hear your voice.
Where are you, David?
Yes, I am from Superior, Wisconsin.
Right.
First, George, I wanted to ask you and your guests also if you guys had ever heard of an author, or if you ever had him on the program, Eckhart Tolle.
Eckhart Tolle, certainly. The Power of Now was the book that really put him on the map.
Oh, yes, yes. I just finished that book, actually. It was quite incredible. Like I said, I'm only 21 years old, but recently I've been having a lot of in and out of body intense experiences. And basically, I just walk around with an overwhelming feeling of love and connectedness. Even tonight, like, I sometimes just lose all recognition of my body and of everything and just become the universe, so to speak. And like you were saying, George, you were saying you don't think that you can stay in this field sometimes, but the way that I feel is that you are the field, and everything and everybody ever is one living organism of love, basically. And one of the you guys were speaking of the doorways earlier. Ancient texts describe how surrender is one of the doorways to this field, if you will. Just to accept the way that it is. It's nothing is good or bad. It's just your mind that identifies with it and feels the need to judge it and split it into two separate categories. But everything just is the way that it is. What I was wondering about is your guest was speaking about how the mass meditation and prayer, it takes, what did you say, it was 1% of
square root of 1% of a given population is what the statistics show in the studies that were published. This was in the Journal of Conflict Resolution, December 1988. Okay. What it takes to jumpstart the effect, but more people certainly make it happen quicker.
Okay, well, I'm a firm believer in what I feel is going to be, so to speak, like a global conscious awakening coming soon. And you were talking about it earlier, sort of along the same lines as that, too. What I'm suggesting is you were saying that there's 8 billion people. We would only need 8,000 people, you were saying.
Of a little over 6 billion people on the planet, if you, on your calculator, the square root of, you take 1% of 6 billion, then you take the square root of that 1%, and the numbers are just a little over 8,000 people. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and even, you know, with a large amount of people, anything, I mean, that's going to be, you know, positive anyways. So, but I mean, if there's any, George, if you're planning on having any focused consciousness or if you guys...
Always.
I wanted to see what you guys thought of that to sort of jumpstart peace. I mean, it would make peace, you know, in the Middle East, for example. I know that experiment that you did the other night, George, with your other guest.
Mm-hmm. With Raymond Grace. And I've got to tell you, I'm not going to count the day 100 people died because that had already occurred or was occurring while we were on the air because it was early morning. It was morning in Baghdad by that time. But
oh, yeah.
Today I would believe to be one of the official days of the start date. Mm. And they had minimal casualties today. So I'm going to watch it for a couple weeks.
Well, you know, one of the things the studies found, both George and David, is that when something like this happens, it doesn't work so well to say, you know, peace in Jerusalem or peace in Baghdad. It's about peace, period. When consciousness is feeling peace, it appears that all that can happen is peace. And when we polarize it and say, you know, here's the good guys, here's the bad guys, and peace over here, and let these guys win, it doesn't appear to be effective in that way. This is about it's about a universal sense of peace, and in the presence of that peace, all that happens is peace. Global studies have been done. The problem is that this is still being looked at as something you do for a moment or 10 minutes or an hour, and then you stop and you walk away. And what the masters of our past have told us and what the laboratory experiments are showing is it's not something you do, it's something you be. It's a way of being. If the world is mirroring what we are feeling collectively, then we're invited to collectively to feel that peace, as Gandhi said, to feel that peace in your heart to the best of your ability. And we all have times where we can feel it more than others, certainly, but to the best of our ability. And in that way, life becomes literally the perpetual prayer. That's the part that has not been really picked up on a large scale. So that's why these things aren't as successful maybe as they could be.
I agree with you, and that's how I've been learning to live, and I have been living like that. So I will continue to project my positive energy onto the globe and try to help evolve humanity in every way that I can, and I will enjoy the rest of the program. Thank you, and you guys both have a wonderful evening.
Thanks, David. Thanks for calling in tonight. Take care.
Appreciate you being part of the program. What do people get when they go to your website, Greg?
What they'll find is a schedule of we do multimedia events all over the world. George, we've got a lot of them in this country. We're showing the video clips of his healings that I'm talking about. We're showing moving images demonstrating the experiments and direct experience in the room, and it's a lot of fun. They're fast moving programs. Of course, all of our recordings are there, and all the references that we're talking about here tonight, the technical references that were too much to mention all in the air, they're all listed under the references section on that website, gregbraden.com.
All right, well, stick with us, Greg Braden, our guest. We'll be back. We're going to take final phone calls. I can't believe how fast this program has run. And, Greg, we want to talk about time also. Time travel, maybe, throughout the Matrix? We'll find out. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, it'll be our Friday night into Saturday morning open lines. Just about anything could happen. But we'll be right back. We'll take final phone calls with Greg Braden on Coast to Coast AM. Rapid night tonight, Greg. How does this equate to time travel, if at all, you can hit the Matrix?
Well, once again, George, and again, this, we talk about more detail in the book, but it's because if time travel is happening, there must be a conduit, something that we're moving through. And within the realm of human experience we're talking about, time and space really don't exist in this realm. That's why, the military has used the Divine Matrix. They didn't call it that. But even as far back as the early 90s in the first Gulf War, they would train individuals in what we now call remote viewing, sitting in an office in Virginia to find Scud missile locations in Iraq, so we didn't have to send live troops in and risk their lives to find them, and they would pinpoint them that way. So distance in that respect really doesn't mean the same thing as it means in our 3D conscious beta state. Time in the laboratory, there are experiments that have been done, fascinating experiments, where quantum particles have been taken into the present moment. In other words, 5 seconds ago, they moved this particle from where it was then to where it is now, and they know all the properties about the particle now. They change that particle now, and what they've found is that it actually changes what it is that happened before the particle ever got there. It's a mind-boggler when you think about these things. But the reason that I talk so much about what's happening with the quantum particles is because we're made of those particles. For 75 years, scientists have tried to convince us we're made of quantum particles, and we believe that now. And now that they're finding all these seemingly miraculous things that these particles do, they say, well, that has nothing to do with our everyday world. And the question I'm asking in the book is, are those quantum particles, are they showing us the anomalies of science, or are they showing us the possibilities that await us as we learn this language of the Divine Matrix? And every one of those miracles, whether it's being in two places at once or instantly connected as in remote viewing, or going from physical energy into invisible matter like the healing of the tumor, every one of those things that we've mentioned, people have done in the past. And if one person can do it, it's probably there for all of us. It's about learning to master this language, and the language is based not in our brains, but it's in our hearts.
All right, let's go to the phones again. Wildcard Line, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Tana, and I'm in Montana.
Hi, Tana.
How are you guys?
Hey, great to hear from you tonight in Montana.
Oh, it's wonderful here. I have kind of a question for you, but a little bit of background. Ever since I was a young child, probably since I could tell time, 11-11 has always been just incredibly important to me. In my young head, that was the time that I had a phone call to God, and I got a minute. And I would be able to catch it. It was odd. I could catch it at least once a day, usually twice a day. And my belief was that I was able to talk to God, ask him for something, and then the angels were going to spread their little wings, and occasionally feathers would fall out of their wings, and they would come down to earth, and my prayer would be answered. Well, growing up in this abusive household and a family that did not believe in God, I realized that God wasn't going to just magically give me a new family. So I kind of changed my thought process. I don't know quite how I did it, but I decided to just be in that moment, in that minute, that I had with God and hoped that possibly that feather would fall. And I stopped hoping for myself, but I started hoping for others to possibly be kinder to me or for something grand to come into my life, something wonderful or somehow find peace within myself. I'm almost 42 now, and I've, for the last 30 years or so, I've been able to do that. And I've talked to friends and family, even though I know they think I'm a little out in left field, they know that at 11:11, if I don't catch it, they catch it. And they do respect that time, and it's quiet because they know that I'm talking or I'm just trying to find some kind of inner peace. My question to you is, I've raised my two daughters to believe in this, and they stop at 11:11, and they also speak their, you know, find their presence with God or their spiritual being or whatever you want to call them. I was wondering if I could get the people who actually do stop at that time and do believe that there is the power within us to change something. If we all got on the same message and we were all putting out the same vibe as far as, you know, possibly asking for somebody to see that there is something greater than themselves. One specific person that, you know, possibly my sister, there is a God, that there is something greater than her, and she, you know, it would be great for her to find that. If we put our three heads together, or even more people at that specific time, in that very moment, is it possible to, you know, really influence a person that way? You know, I suppose it'd be considered even miracles. As, you know, you're talking about shrinking tumors. Is it possible, do you suppose, if we all were doing the same thing at that same time?
Well, you just covered a lot of ground.
I know, I'm sorry.
with that. So there are about three different questions that I'm hearing in there. But the bottom line is this field will mirror back what it is that we're feeling. So rather than asking that something happen, the key, the language the field recognizes, is to feel as if it's already happened. So that's number one. Number two, my experience is that it is probably not going to be successful to try to convince or persuade anyone of anything because people just don't work that way. The best thing to do is just to live whatever it means in your life, and by example, other people often will pick up the nonverbal cues. And number three, yes, what the experiments have shown is where multiple people come together in a common shared experience, that effect can be mirrored back into their lives or the bodies of their loved ones. The key is, once again, to feel as if rather than asking for. And just think about this. When you ask for something to happen, and it's important this makes sense before we hang up, when you ask for something, even when it's well-intentioned, if you're asking for the healing to be here now, for example, or for peace to be in our world, what you've just implied is that it's not there right now because you're asking for it to happen. And this field is very literal. It will mirror back the fact that it is not there now. Or if you say, I want something to happen, the field will say, okay, I'll let you want and want and want. It's a literal field is what the experiments have shown. So the key is to be very specific and to be very precise in the outcome, very clear about what that outcome is, and to feel as if that outcome has already happened.
Great. Thank you for the response. Let's go west of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. It's your turn. Hi there.
Hello, gentlemen. Good morning.
Good evening. West of the Rockies, you're in our part of the world.
Yes. Well, Greg, yes. I have an interesting question to ask you. And thanks to my friend Sandy, now this message will be heard through millions. With love being the most powerful emotion known to mankind, if we were to express collectively our thoughts with love to all those who we cared about, our dear and loved ones, and then we thought about those who we didn't like, disliked, and we sent them love, what would the preponderance of the effects be?
Well, there's two keys to what you're saying, and the first is that love is a feeling. So and that's not happening in your mind. You're thinking about something in your mind, and into that thing you are pumping, you're imbuing that thought with the power of emotion that comes from your heart. So love is the feeling. And rather than it be specific, it can be, what happens is the field mirrors back very literally what it is that we're feeling, and you don't have to send it anywhere. It's already there. And this is precisely what the studies were showing with the DNA. It's what they were showing with the experiments in the Middle East, whether it's love or whether it's peace, whatever it is. So you can create those effects. However, unless those individuals are open and willing to receive that experience, the effects may be short-lived. And that's the key. And when people are talking about imposing their will through this field, we can be very well-intentioned and send offer our love to our loved ones. And the flip side of that equation is they have to be open and willing and ready to receive that love.
And we equally do that to people we transgressed in our past to seek release and restitution and
sure.
Send them love?
We can, and we have to be also at a point of moving beyond the judgment and the ego. I mean, as a scientist, this is a very different realm for me to be talking about, and it's what the studies are showing. The emotions are most effective when we're not in a place of judgment or ego, which means we're okay whether we see the effects or not. I mean, that's the irony. The irony is that when we have the power to create these effects, the greatest power comes from the least ego and attachment to the outcome, if that makes any sense at all.
Well, I had to ask that as in the movie What Dreams May Come.
Oh,
from
sure.
Classic.
Williams. It seemed apparent that those who we suffer, we create our own hell, if you will, you know, in the afterlife, because we didn't have final release of all the things we've done, transgressed, and we carry that guilt. So if we release all our transgressions with love to those who we transgressed, you know, who've done us wrong, we've done them wrong back, say, and that would seek release, so we're forgiven, we feel that peace, so we can evolve and
move on. Now I know where the question's coming from. Sure, we can do that. The key is to be able to do that. We have to know that is possible. We have to understand how this works, and not everyone has that understanding right now. So,
and I equally think about, you know, love being like the example of Fritz Lang's Metropolis. The message was clear there. I mean, between the head and hands, there has to be a mediator, and that mediator has to be heart.
Sure.
And it's kind of odd because that came out of Germany prior to, you know, the rise of the Nazi Empire, but they forgot about that message. And so I'm hoping that we will remember that message that I'm, you know, messaging to everybody on Coast to think about that clearly.
Well, I believe we are, and I think, again, we spoke about this earlier, that's our time in history is pushing us to the point where it's not a nice leisurely pastime. It now has become a necessity to transcend. We don't want to just survive. We want to transcend the crises of our time in history. And to do that, we have to come to these understandings. Different language for different people, and the experiences are very subjective. They're different for different people. The key is that we recognize that we're empowered to participate and contribute to the world in meaningful ways, and that cooperation rather than competition is the way we're going to go, and that we are a family, and that we have the power in our hearts to create in our imagination and in our heart's desire what it is we'd like to experience, knowing that the world, this field is going to mirror it back to us. And the science is important because it shows us that this is true, and the ancient traditions show us it's been true for over 5,000 years.
Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to the program. Hi there. Hello. Well, that person is not there. Obviously trapped in the matrix somewhere. Wild card line 2, you're on the air. Hi there.
Hello?
Yeah.
Hello.
Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, this is Paul from Alaska.
All right, Paul, go.
Hey, Paul, welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you. It's a nice to have your show. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you.
On your guest tonight, I have a couple of questions. About a year ago, that particular energy field that you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
I feel as though I got somehow wrapped up in it. as though it comes and goes, and then it started to get really strong over, say, the last 6 months. And I wonder if there's like a signature that it picks up on, or is it a certain, you know, does like energy have a signature or a DNA that it can rectify with, or you just did I just fall into this matrix wave or what?
Well, we're talking about different levels of energy. They're at the most fundamental level, this energy is where everything else comes from. So you didn't fall into it. You've always been part of this field. Within that context, there are waves that are called gift waves, love waves, all kinds of waves that move through this field. But I would say this to you, Paul, if you are sensitive enough to have the experience, you're probably sensitive enough to ask yourself what that experience is and what it means to you, because it is subjective, and your experience is going to be different from the person next to you. So I would close your eyes, take a deep breath, be very quiet, and go in and just say, what is it that I'm feeling, and why is it significant in my life? And you'll probably be amazed at what comes back to you when you do that.
One or two more, and that's it. East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Good morning, George. It's Dan from Harrisburg.
Sure, Dan. Thanks for calling.
Mitch Hukako brought up in an interview that you did with him a while back about us being a zero civilization in relation to ETs, and until we got to a three or four and got past our warring amongst ourselves and the corruption in politics and religion, that we would never achieve that status. And I believe that Greg is touching on exactly what it's going to take to get to that status through mass consciousness. And I guess my question is, throughout history, I think we've seen glimpses of it from people such as Da Vinci, where they were able to rise above their situation of the power struggle at the time or the religious struggle at the time to do great things and unlock their mind into that stream of consciousness. And I'm just asking, I guess, as a whole, what can we do as a society of a race of a human being to get to that stage to where we get past our own shortcomings and achieve what is lying as our potential as mankind?
Sure. Well, I know Michio. I've had the honor of sharing the stage with him a number of times. We've actually had this conversation, and he's quoting from the Russian physicist that talked about type 1, 2, and 3 civilizations, and we're still the type 0 based on the energy that we use and the where we get our energy from. And I think what you're saying is right. What we can do, this is the beauty and the simplicity of the divine matrix, the principle of entanglement and the principle of the hologram, is that you're already doing it. The way you live your life every day, and the way I live mine, and the way George lives his, and all of our listeners, at the family dinner table, at the workplace, driving in the freeway, those little moments in life become our collective answer to this time in history. And if we're conditioned in all those little moments to live our lives in fear and anxiety, that's what we're gonna see in the world around us. If we can find a way to transcend that fear and anxiety in our personal lives, acknowledging that, sure, it may be happening in the world around us, it doesn't have to be necessarily a part of our lives every moment of every day. That's the way this field responds in small communities and between nations. So I know it sounds almost too simple to be true, but that's what the studies have shown, that's what the experiments shown, and that's what 5,000-year-old texts are saying to us right now.
All right, very good. Greg, we're out of time. I want to thank you for a really fascinating program today.
George, God bless. Thank you for being such a gracious host and for the forum so we can have these conversations. And I'm amazed how quickly our time passed tonight.
Name of the book, The Divine Matrix, I assume, available everywhere?
It's available everywhere, Amazon.com and wherever books are sold.
You got it. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Wayne Roberts, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, Art Bell, and a cast of 10,000 others, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.